I'm very pleased to be here, part of this conference. So I'm going to speak about long time. Long time for NLS. Long time behavior for the defocusing NLS, and this is joint with Jinja. So let me of course write down the equation. IQT plus QXX minus 2 Q say Q equals 0 T equals 0 goes to 0 as X goes to 0. So we're on the whole line, and the question is this. Maybe a different color is better, I don't know. We'll try that. So question is, what's the long time behavior of the equation? I'm particularly interested in the case, and I'll explain why as I go along. Q0 of x has minimal smoothness and decay. So that's the particular interest, and again I'll say why I have this interest. So let me give an outline of the talk. So firstly I'll say a little bit what is known up till now, and then I'll say a little bit about why we're interested in this, and then there's sort of a theme of what I'm going to speak about, and it's how to use the oscillations which are present in the system. So then the next part, it will be a statement of the result. Part C is just some key ideas of the proof. And then I want to speak about an extended result. In other words, under more general conditions than I'll initially speak about. So I'll start off with the first part, what's known up till now. Now, I need to say a little bit about NLS as an isospectral deformation to be able to describe what's going on. One looks at the following operator, L of Q, I sigma, or minus I sigma, d by dx, minus 0, q of x bar, is 1 half this matrix. So this is an operator which one can think of as, say, some analog of a Schrodinger operator. You think of q of x dying as x gets large, so you have a scattering theory. And coming out of the scattering theory, there will be a reflection coefficient, which we'll call R. And one should think of that as being some functional of Q. And the map Q to R is a scattering map. So I'll refer to R as the scattering map. And of course, the map from R to Q is the inverse scattering map. The nature of this map, which is some kind of non-linear Fourier type map, is very important to everything that we do. When Q and R are small, it's basically a Fourier type relationship. So one thinks of it as some kind of non-linear Fourier map. And I'm going to make precise in a little while exactly what is known as about this map as a map between different Banach spaces. And an important fact to realize, and this is, I'm just going to say it here, is that R has got a supernorm which is strictly less than 1. So the map from Q to R is a map into functions with supernorms strictly less than 1. So just remember that. Okay. Now, the great realization was due to Zakharov and Shabbat in 1972, I think it is. And they made the following observation. If you started with some initial data and you evolve it under NLS to a solution Q of T, of course for any T, Q of T is a function of X, and then you map that to R of T under our map R, Q of T, then this evolves in a very simple fashion. In fact, these are the action angle variables for the flow, and this would be given by R at T equals 0 times e to the minus I z squared t. So the variable z is for any t, R of t is a function of z. I really mean rt is a function of z. And that's the z variable, which is sitting up here. So q is a function of x, and r is a function of z. So if you take a logarithm of r, you get a straight line motion. So the solution algorithm is you start with Q, you go to Q0, you construct R at T equals 0, and then you go down, you let Q is then the inverse map. This is R inverse of R at T equals 0, e to the minus I, let me call it dot squared T. So that's the solution algorithm. Okay, now I want you to just bear this in mind as we go on. So again, in 1976, Zakharov, Monaco, were able to compute the asymptotic solution. They showed that Q of x t, as t went to infinity, looked like special form QASXT, which is equal to this 1 over t to the half alpha of b0 e to the I x squared over 4t minus I nu of z0 log t. Now z0 is that value, and nu of v0 is equal to minus 1 upon 2 pi log of 1 minus r v0 squared. Say a little bit about nu. Now, what I want you to see from this explicit form is that here r the reflection coefficient corresponding to the initial data. So it's telling you how to compute the long-time behavior explicitly in terms of the initial data, and particularly in terms of the reflection coefficient of the initial data. There's a similar expression for alpha. Alpha is equal to alpha of z. It's got a modulus which looks like this. Let me write this down. Is equal to this nu of z0 upon 2, the half e to the I, and some similar expression just involving r. So everything is explicit. Now, this is the result of Zakharov and Minakov. It's really a critical piece of work, but there were no estimates. So one didn't know how good an approximation this was. Then in decaying initial data. There's no sense of a precise result in the thinking of a problem. Okay, but I mean it's a critical breakthrough.
Is V0
for any x and t.
No, but what's V0?
X over 2. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then, if Joe and myself, at the early stage when we were introducing a stationary phase method for Riemann-Hilbert problems, we were actually able to prove this, that if Q of zero has sufficiently many derivatives and decay, Q of xt is Q asymptotic xt plus log t over t. Big order. Log t over t. Beg your pardon? Okay, so Q of xt is this thing plus something which is beg your pardon? So it's something like 5 derivatives decaying with order 1 over x to the 10, something like that. I'll say more about that. About 5 derivatives, each decaying like 1 over x to the 10. So, and I want to say more about that later. This was done, this method was done as one of the first applications of this steepest descent method for Riemann-Hilbert problem, which Jin and I had introduced, and which has since been developed in many directions with Stefanos and with Alex and many other people. Okay, so, but what we're interested in is the result where you don't have this many derivatives. Okay. Now, so in recent work, so this is with Joe and myself, we were interested in perturbations of NLS. You put an epsilon on the front. And again, Q of x at time t equals 0, some given function which decays at infinity, and W of q is arbitrary except it should look like some power as q goes to 0, and this power should be sufficiently large. Ideally, L should be bigger than 2, but in the results which I'm going to describe briefly now, L turns out for technical reasons to be bigger than 7 over 2. But it should really, what we're saying now, should really be true just if L is bigger than 2. Now, we looked at this particular problem in sort of the smallest, for want of a word, natural space in which you have global existence and uniqueness. So the initial data, Q0, belong to H11, instead of Q prime, XQ belong to L2. It's a natural space. And you have a global existence. Now, our results were of three kinds. So the first kind, which really sort of indicates that where you solve an equation is extremely important. So in other words, if you solve the periodic problem, you solve the problem the whole line, it's very, very different. You can't just look at the algebra. And that's because new phenomena take place. On the whole line, you have the possibility of things spreading out, and this is an absolutely fundamental phenomenon which is not present in the periodic case. So the first result is that this equation is completely integrable. So it came as something of a surprise to us, because we always thought of this as the prototype non-integral equation. So a precise statement of this result is you can show that there exists an open invariant subspace of phase space in which you have whatever notion of integrability you want, lax pair, commuting integrals, etc. Yeah. 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 So it's positive. Now, the next result was a long time behavior, so Q of T with an. What?
The first
result. No.
Result A is on a neighborhood.
No.
It's an open set of phase space.
Yeah.
It's an open, unbounded set of phase space.
Yeah. Yeah. You take
open
Q.
Dense, unbounded
space? No. We don't know. It's probably true everywhere, but this is what we can prove. And, okay.
For any W?
For any W looking like that. Now, there's a result that says that Q epsilon of T will look like Q epsilon equals zero of T as T goes to infinity. So by the epsilon is zero cases, of course, in NLS. And we're saying that solutions of this equation look like solutions of NLS when T gets large. And then there's a sense of question of universality, which we borrow from, say, what people think about now in random matrix theory, that if you scale a problem appropriately, all problems look the same. So there's the notion that if you look at this equation on the right scale, it will look like a solution of NLS, no matter what W is. Now, you see, the fact which I want to focus on now is that we're looking at this space. We're looking at solutions in this space. And we're saying that solutions of this equation for a long time look like solutions of NLS for large time. So an imperative on you is that you have to be able to say what solutions of NLS look like, just with the assumption that the initial data is in the H11 space. So that is why that's the origin of the problem I'm speaking today.
What's the role of the epsilon?
Okay, you can play it in two ways, right? Is that if I take any point in phase space, this is H11, then I have to make epsilon sufficiently small to be able to see which of these invariant sets I'm lying in. On the other hand, if I want to pick epsilon equal to 1, say, then I must go closer. I must take smaller initial data.
So the open set you're describing thins out as I enlarge the radius.
Right. But the union of all of them isn't for fixed epsilon. Put epsilon equals 1. This result is probably true for all initial data. Okay, so now. That's right. We believe that's true. Well, it will become trivial, the scattering trend, in those variables. Let me say more about that later on. Okay, so. What we need to focus on is solving the NLS equation just with data in H11 and be able to describe the long time behavior. So I'll say a little bit as we go along why it is that in our initial calculation we needed this 10 orders of decay and five derivatives. Now, I want to move on to the second part, which is to begin to describe the results from this talk. So, what might we look for? What kind of result should be true just with the H11? Well, we find that if we look at the free wave with some initial data, which decays as x gets large, simple exercise will look like 1 over t to the half. There'll be some object here over 4t plus something which is order t to the 3/4. Now, if you take initial data, q0 belongs to h11, and for q0 free, right? You will get this result here. This is essentially the Fourier transform of the initial data evaluated at the point x over 2t. And you get an error estimate of 1 over t to the 3/4 in supernorm. So this is sort of the maximal, the best one could hope for, in the sense that the free problem gives us the guide. Something else one should look at is you see here a fundamental difference in NLS and the free problem. NLS never becomes free. You always have a logarithmic counter term. So if you want to think in terms of renormalization theory, you want to ask, what is it possible that solutions of NLS are just the same as the solution of the free equation? You have to add in the counter term in the phase, which has to grow logarithmically with time. You can't find a global counter term. So putting that aside, this is the best error term that one can have. And the results which I want to describe today is that this is now for NLS, Q of XT solves NLS with initial data belong to H11. This implies that Q of XT equals this asymptotic form plus order 1 over t to the 1/2 plus kappa. And kappa is any number between 0 and 1/4. So I should, to put the quantifiers in, I should really say the following. Pick any number kappa between 0 and 1/4. Then you'll be able to show that this is equal to that plus something with a constant independent of x. And independent and dependent on kappa divided by t to the 1/2 plus 1/4. So this is morally as close as one can get to this result. So we're able to do as well in the interacting in the nonlinear case as in the linear case. Beg your pardon? Implied norm is L infinity. Okay. Now, some ideas. I started a little late. How much time do I have? About
15 minutes.
Okay, thank you. So we need to say a little bit about the Riemann-Hilbert problem, which Jinjo spoke about last night. Is that so we are given, okay, we're given R, which is the reflection coefficient for the initial data, Q0. Let me just put in the fact, and this is due to Jinjo, the map from Q to R, which is the reflection coefficient of Q, is a bijection from H11 onto H111. So So it takes functions with one derivative and one order of decay in L2 to functions with one derivative and one order of decay, and this one indicates that the supernorm is strictly less than one. So it maps bijectively, in fact, in a bi-Lipschitz fashion, onto the interior of the unit ball in H111. So given R, let M, which is 2 by 2, solve the Riemann-Hilbert problem, which looks morally like this. M of Z is analytic, and C take away the real line, so it's analytic above and below. It's 2 by 2 matrix, M plus equals M minus times V theta of Z. Z belongs to R, and I'll say what V theta is in a moment. That is the jump matrix, and M of Z goes to the identity, 2 by 2 identity, and V goes to infinity. Here, V of theta is 1 minus R of Z squared, R e to the I theta, minus R bar e to the minus I theta. Maybe there's no minus. Is that right? No, there is a minus. Yeah. And there's a 1 here. And theta is equal to xz minus tz squared. This is the phase function. And the state stationary phase point is what we call z0 after all. So you're given this, and you fix x and t. So these numbers are fixed, and you solve this Riemann-Hilbert problem. In other words, you then look for a function, a 2 by 2 function, which is analytic above and below, and which has these jumps. Of course, if you give me a z here, as Jin explained, m plus is the boundary value of m from above, and then minus is the boundary value from below. Now, if you solve this problem, there's this following miraculous fact. Problem without any bound states. You can easily show that because the underlying operator which we wrote down is a self-adjoint operator. So any eigenvalues have to be real, and any solutions of that equation are real, look asymptotically of order 1. They don't decay. So for the defocusing case, there's just no soliton. So M looks like 1. M1 of xt over z. So I'm just expanding out the third normalization condition like this. And if we look at M1 of xt, and we look at it 1-2 entry, and we multiply by minus r, that's the solution of NLS. It's a remarkable thought and formula that you solve this complex variable problem, you extract the residue at infinity, and from it you see. So you see then, the question of the behavior of this problem is really the nonlinear realization of that multiplier. You've got your solution is a functional of the multiplier, R times d to the I theta, which looks like it. So this is, in a very intuitive sense, a nonlinear Fourier analysis or Fourier integral time type problem. And it was, we all know that if everything were linear, you would then be dealing with the method of stationary phase, steepest descent. So the question was whether there's a method which will handle such problems which are fully nonlinear, and that's the method that Jin and I introduced. The steepest descent method precisely for such problems. So to be able to describe a long-time behavior, you have to do this kind of nonlinear Fourier analysis. So I want to say a little bit about how the thing works, and then give some idea of why one can handle the smoothness restrictions. So the key fact is you have to look at the real part of I theta. Now, if you look at the real part of our theta, here is z0, we're in the z-plane, then you'll find here that it's positive, the real part of our theta is positive here, it's positive here, negative here, negative here. So I just ask you to just imprint that figure on your mind, because somehow what you want to do, if we think back to the original steepest descent method, you try and deform your contours in the classical method to make sure that your exponential factors are in your favor. So if you have an e to the I theta, you would like to have it sitting in here. If you have an e to the minus I theta, you'd like to have it sitting in here. But here comes the big difference between the matrix problem and the scalar problem, is the e to the I theta is algebraically linked to the e to the minus I theta. So if you try to move it into the place where this guy is good, you're pulling this guy with you. It's bad. So there's an essential question of how do you decouple these two objects. You have to decouple it algebraically, and that's done by taking this matrix . Well, this has two factorizations. Just multiply those matrices together. You have that. But it also has a second factorization. And it looks like this. Again, little piece of algebra. One is a lower upper factorization, another is an upper lower factorization. So these are two factorizations, and you see we're beginning to perform the splitting between the e to the I theta and the e to the I. Intuitively, the idea is you want to move this guy into this place, there or there, and you want to move this guy into that place or that case. So now, we don't like, you see it's very important now that the soup norm is strictly less than one so that this thing doesn't blow up. So what we do, first of all, we want to remove this diagonal piece. So we want to take this guy here and we want to remove it. That's done by a device of introducing an auxiliary object, delta of z, which solves the following Riemann-Hilbert problem. Delta of z, scalar, solved, is analytic in c take away minus infinity z zero. So, in the complement of the split plane, or in, right? And delta plus equals delta minus times 1 minus r of z squared. So z belongs to minus infinity z zero. And delta of z goes to 1 as z goes to... This is a device which we will use. So this is some scalar function. You can write down an explicit formula for it. Now, the advantage of this object is it's going to remove that, sort of a little exercise, that if this one here, delta plus minus times 1 minus r of z squared. That's the jump condition. Okay. So then, if you define m hat of z to be m times delta inverse 0, 0 delta, the definition, then m hat or unhat will itself satisfy a Riemann-Hilbert problem. And this will solve a Riemann-Hilbert problem, so m hat will be analytic above, analytic below, it will have jumps across the axis. And what the jumps will look like, it solves a Riemann-Hilbert problem with a jump matrix, which I'll call V unhat of theta. And the question is, what does this look like? Well, when you work it out, it looks like this. This is what this is. You'll find it looks here like 1, 0, r, e to the I theta, delta squared, 1. And here it is 1 minus r bar, e to the minus I theta, delta to the minus 2, 0, 1. And over here it looks like this. 1, e to the minus I theta, delta minus to the minus 2, squared 0, 1, times theta, delta squared, from the plus side, and we get a 1 over here. So this product is what V looks like to the right of V0, and this is what it looks like to the left. I'm sorry to drag you through these details, but we're almost done. So, okay. Now, you see, to fill in, we've got M plus equals M minus. So let me put it in here. And now comes the sort of key observation. You see, if you take the M hat minus up there, you see it is geographically located next to that matrix, 1, 0, R. This one we can pull down to the other side, this one here, take its inverse and attach it to the function M hat plus. So we call the new analytic M's, the ones which are given by M times this. And then you deform, and this problem here will now become a problem on a contour looking like this, with a jump which looks like this. There is a 1, 0, 1 minus R bar, e to the minus I theta, delta to the minus 2. Here it will be 1, 0, r, e to the I theta, delta squared, 1. Here it will be 1, 0, r, e to the I theta, delta squared, and minus r squared, 1. And a similar thing over here, which involves an e to the minus I theta. Now, morally, you see how the method works. We've deformed the original problem into one in which the e to the I theta is in the right position. You've got e to the minus I theta sitting in this part. E to the I theta is sitting here. So each of these factors are now exponentially decreasing, and your problem's going to localize around there. You get essentially a constant coefficient Riemann-Hilbert problem, and as one knows after a while, such Riemann-Hilbert problems can be solved explicitly. You solve it, and you see this Q asymptotic form coming out. But now the issue becomes clear. Sitting in here, to do this deformation, you, as I've done it, you need to know that R, R bar, and this combination, you have got analytic continuations. Well, they don't. In general, they don't. In general, R is just a function H1, 1, 1. So some kind of approximation has to be done. And that's where initially, in the initial work, very crude approximations could be done, because you just assumed as many derivatives as you needed. Then all estimates came out in terms of just absolute estimates. You estimate an integral by taking the absolute sign within it. You've got enough decay, enough smoothness for that to work. So there's some approximation of the R's has to be done. But now, one hasn't got enough. So to be able to do this, you have to take into account some subtle cancellations. So you've got to take into account the oscillations. Now, the nature of the oscillations are of two kinds. There are some which are familiar within classical harmonic analysis, the way you would capture oscillations, you've got some integral. But others really are the nature of a more algebraic nature. I just want to spend my last 3 or 4 minutes giving you just some sense of two of the cancellations, or two of the type of estimates which are needed at that stage. So morally, this is how things work. The obstacle is that R and R bar are not analytic functions. They have to be sufficiently well approximated, but you only have in your hand that your functions are in H11. Yeah.
Second line in the middle board, Q is
related.
Yeah. Is the W in play here?
No. Is that the whole thing is this, is that just as when you do ordinary position theory, suppose you want to do perturbations of the wave equation. What you do is you write it in a due, you've got the wave equation, you write it with a Duhamel type formula. Then your analysis is as successful as your understanding of classical harmonic analysis. Everything depends on estimates, which you then plug in there. Now what happens now, in place, exactly in the same place that you had the Fourier map, you now have the scattering map R. It's a property, it's the scattering map which we're analyzing at this point, and that will be used to feed into the Duhamel thing on the right hand side. So this is all genuinely, for want of a phrase, the non-linear harmonic analysis in the problem. Because the NLS equation never looks like the free equation, you don't have the option of using Fourier analysis. Okay. So, as Jin pointed out, when you're dealing with the Riemann-Hilbert problem, ultimately the operator you have to control for any contour, let's call it a contour sigma, is the Cauchy operator. Sigma, so you've got some oriented contour. So sigma, and it's this operator that you have to control. It's LP mapping properties, etc. C plus minus is just the operator you get by letting Z approach a point on the axis, either from the plus side or the minus side. And you want the mapping properties, or many classical mapping properties, which I'm not going to go into, but I want to give just two examples of the kind of estimates which are needed. One is that it looks like the C plus minus sigma delta plus minus F e to the minus of plus IT, and let me use Lozenger for my dummy symbol. You want to know this LP of sigma T to the 1 over 2P F in H10. Okay, and this is on 0 infinity divided by 1 minus rho. Rho is the supernormal. So H10 means one derivative in L2, no orders of decay. And so here's the delta that we introduced before. F is some function which is defined on a half line. And now you want, maybe the contour comes up somewhere like this, and data is defined there, and you want to know something about the LP properties and all the other lines, including the original line. So you want to prove a bound like this. Now, what is subtle about the bound is that a key feature of this operator, as Jin mentioned, is C plus minus C minus is the identity. So if we look at C plus, so delta minus F minus or plus IT sigma minus C minus, that's just equal to delta to the plus minus 2 F e to the minus or plus IT squared, because C plus minus C minus. Now, you want decay on one of these things, but it's clear this object has no decay. The L2 norm remains fixed. So if this one decays, this one cannot decay. So what you have to be sure is you've got to have all the signs matching exactly right. it's not exactly, not let us think about why this particular cancellation is taking place. Now, I just want to give some, so this is one kind of estimation which I would say was more in the line of the classical type of capturing of oscillations. A different one is of the following kind. It will take me 2 minutes to do it. We look at theta at time t equals zero, it's just xz. And our factorization vx looks like this, 1, 0, r e to the I dx, 1 minus r bar e to the minus I dx. So that was one of the two factorizations we put down. So v plus of x minus 1 is this matrix. And v minus of x minus 1 is this matrix. Now, what one can show is that v plus 1 minus vx minus, well, I'll put a minus here and a plus here, and L2 is bounded by a constant, in fact, 1 over 1 plus x squared times r, which one here, this is as x, or x negative. This is a bound which is not that hard to prove. But now, it turns out that when we're trying to analyze the deformation there, what we need is an integral of this kind, c plus 1 minus vx minus, plus c minus vx plus minus 1, z, v plus x minus v minus x. And this is over r. And we want to prove that this is less than or equal to. I'm just using this by way of illustration. Now, what's the first kind of cancellation? Is that you notice that this matrix here, if you look up there, is purely upper triangular. So if you write this as v minus 1 minus 1 minus v, you'll see that if you take the vx, the plus minus 1, and you hit it on here, it's going to remain. But if you take the 1 minus v minus part, that's upper triangular. This is upper triangular, so it just drops out. So it's the first algebraic piece of cancellation. So you get 1 minus vx minus times vx plus minus 1. And similarly over here. So I'm saying from these things, just this one can remain. The next thing that happens, so this is purely an algebraic fact. The next fact is here we can put in a c plus minus c minus, because it's equal to 1. Now the c plus part and the c plus part is a product of two analytic functions. Their integral over the real line is just 0 by Cauchy's theorem. So this part just drops out. So you just left with c minus on here. And now you see you're in good shape because it's the c plus with the v minus which decays. And it's a c minus with the v plus which decays in L2. That's how you get it. So here you have two kinds of cancellation. One is of the classical type. The other is, of course, of the algebra, the way things actually are positioned in algebra space. Okay, I'll stop at this point. Thank you.